from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. It is hard enough growing up as a young man with all the confusion, awkwardness, and hormones of youth. For Alex Tizon, it was made even harder as a Filipino immigrant to America. He always knew he was an outsider, but somehow the various cultural stereotypes about Asian men, nerdy, weak, generally not sexy, felt both unfair and incorrect. That need to know his culture led to a lifelong exploration of Asia detailed in his new book, Big Little Man. In this hour, we'll meet Alex Tizon, learn about his journey, and candidly explore the stereotypes and myths about Asian men. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. What do you think of when you think of Asian men? And yes, I'm asking you this even if you are one. What do you think of? Someone short, nerdy, socially awkward, maybe someone subservient, weak, mysterious? Perhaps it's the Silicon Valley image, super smart, ultra-driven. But I'm guessing the words powerful, charming, or sexy probably did not spring to mind. For Alex Tizon, describing Asian culture for himself within himself has been a lifelong journey of discovery and healing. He has spent much of his life trying to understand not just his Filipino culture, but to make sense of how so many stereotypes about men of the Asian diaspora came to be. His journey is the subject of a new book called Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. Today, he teaches journalism at the University of Oregon. His reporting on corruption in federal housing for Native Americans won him a Pulitzer Prize. Alex Tizon, welcome to Forum.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
Now, this is going to be a fairly candid hour, and we need to hear from you.
Let's do
What stereotypes about Asian men drive you crazy? Which ones do you think need explaining or dispelling? And if you are an Asian man listening, what do you wish people would stop saying about you? Or maybe start saying? Call us, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Alex Tizon, what is the earliest stereotype about Asian men that you can remember hearing, reading, seeing, experiencing?
I think you mentioned a few of them right in your introduction. That was a great intro, by the way. I want to tape that and bring it with me wherever I go.
It'll be online. It'll be online. Well, what's the earliest one you remember?
It had to have been that we're all smart and we know kung fu and we're little. Little. I grew up with the word little. There's my little friend Alex. And, you know, I didn't mind it for most of my growing up. So it really only began to matter when I got to be an older adolescent and was looking for a wife, man. And
puberty changes things.
Puberty changes everything.
Right,
all of a sudden, you don't want to be called little.
Right.
You know?
Well, and then there's something just kind of, you know, emasculating about being viewed as not only diminutive in stature, but diminutive in the eyes of a culture that you are not part of. It's like a double diminution, really.
And we were diminutive in every way. That was the point of the book, was to talk about the smallness that we came over with from the Philippines. We were incredibly poor, so we were small economically. We came from a country that it's a really a marginal country. So we were geopolitically small. We were small socially. We were all not conversant in English when we first arrived. So we were awkward, socially small. Physically, we were smaller than most Americans on average, shorter anyway. And so small, I'm using the word small, not just in terms of describing my body, small in every way. And I felt that diminutiveness.
And then being in a country that's so much about expansion and growth and manifest destiny, historically, that must have felt like a real just fish out of water.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I described America as the land of big everything. And one of the chapters, in fact, it's called Land of the Giants. For us coming into the country, we were surrounded by people who were big in everything that we desired. They were, you know, they were, America was, America and Americans were larger than life, big economically, big socially, had big voices, had big bodies. And so we came to this land of the giants, feeling fairly small. Now, you know, I don't want to make it sound like, my family, we were cowering in the corner or that we were, you know, we tiptoed around the giants. No, we were in there all the way. I didn't feel the negative part of my so-called smallness until I got older and started seeing where the small, you know, the idea or the aura of smallness impacted my interactions with other people, with women.
Before we get to that point and your interactions with women, how old were you when you came and your family came from the Philippines to the United States?
I was 4 years old.
So you're just a little kid.
Little kid, but I grew up with Tagalog. So came into school, you know, kindergarten, first grade. I had to learn English, how to speak it, and I'm still kind of learning. But the language structures in my head are Tagalog, and English has been overlaid on top of it. So you're
kind of doing a translation down through English.
Kind of, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So it's a more complicated process to say a simple sentence for me.
Where did your family settle from the Philippines in the U.S.? Where did they land? Where did they arrive?
Well, we landed in Los Angeles, but we only stayed in Los Angeles for under a year. We moved around a lot, all over. We lived in New York City. I lived in the Bronx for 3 years, lived in Honolulu for a while, lived in Seattle for a while, lived in Portland. We crossed the country in a U-Haul twice and stopped all along the way. So we were a migrant family in a way.
And it was you, mom, dad, siblings?
And yes, my dad, my mother, four siblings, five kids total. And we had an aunt with us who lived with us until she died.
Did you always have a clear understanding of why your family left the Philippines for the U.S.? Was it clear to you what this journey was about?
Yes. Even from a young age, my mother and father and all Filipinos, I should say, almost, you know, they worship the United States. They think of the United States as this holy land in a way, a golden land full of golden people who live golden lives. They wanted that for themselves or a piece of it. I knew that even as a young boy, that we were coming into a land where everybody was trying to go, but only a few actually got to go in. So we felt lucky to have been allowed in. and that was what drove my parents. But they had it tough. They came in midlife. They had these, you know, they had degrees, these graduate. My dad had a law degree. My mother went to medical school. Of course, when we came here, those meant absolutely nothing.
So they were really starting from zero. They almost were starting from less than zero because they were educated, but then they had to start all over again in the U.S.
My dad was cleaning trailers in a trailer park at night for a long time to supplement his – he had a small government income as well. It's very small. So, yeah, he's a guy with a law degree cleaning trailers for people. So he was vastly demoted in the new land. But I think he knew that was going to happen. He had a hard time with it, though.
Talk to me about the earliest experiences you had where your Asian heritage, and I say Asian broadly rather than Filipino, because from reading the book, it seems like people did not really know to guess that you might be Filipino.
Right.
They knew of, like, Bruce Lee and David Carradine, and that was like it, basically. Give me an example of when your Asian heritage began to clearly create disadvantage, distance, cultural ignorance, a gulf between you and everybody else.
I really felt it living in the Bronx. We moved to the Bronx. I was 13, coming up into my adolescence, and We lived in South Bronx, which at the time was primarily black and Puerto Rican. There were a few Chinese, but they didn't want to have anything to do with me. I don't think there were people in my neighborhood. This was in the early 70s. Never seen a Filipino before. I somehow resembled a Chinese person. So I got called Chink a lot. Hmm. Yo, Chink, you.
Right.
you know, that it bothered me on a lot of levels that I was called that, regarded that, because I wasn't Chinese. I didn't know anything about China. The Chinese people that I knew didn't want anything to do with me. So I was, it was for me a form of being not seen, really. I was being lumped in with this group that I, at the time, didn't really, I didn't associate myself with, being a Chink.
Right.
I still get called that once in a while.
Oh, Lord. Not on this show. Better not.
Hey, I could live with it, man.
Well, I we have an FCC license to worry about. I want to get to some of these calls. We have a bunch of great calls, and I'm sure we're going to get a lot more. And for those of you who want to chime in on the conversation, please call in 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Before we go to the phones, I want to get a little bit into the meat of this book. I found this book fascinating and unsettling, partly because A, of what you went through, B, of the stereotypes that it deals with, but C, your effort to try to understand these stereotypes for yourself. All these stereotypes come from somewhere. I had to deal with some of them being African American, so I know the stereotypes about black culture, particularly black Southern culture, that my family, especially my mother and my stepdad, have really tried to expose for me. You went so far as to begin keeping clippings and articles. Like, you kept file folders full of materials.
I was an obsessive little man.
That referenced, yeah, but it got you a book of materials that referenced Asians and Asian culture, yeah, to the point where eventually you as an adult could say, this isn't true, that's not true, this is the wrong story, that's where this comes from. And you kind of sowed the seeds for your own cultural rebirth.
You know, it was, I started this so-called personal investigation when I was 13 or 14. Started keeping those files, reading articles, clipping them, filing them away. For years, I didn't know what the hell I was doing it for. I didn't know the purpose. I just thought I was interested in it. You know, I was collecting things like a kid might collect rocks or something. It wasn't really until I was in college, when I had a lot of files by that time, I realized what I was doing was trying to find a sense of worth in myself, trying to connect to some lineage that I could be proud of, trying to build a case for myself as a man and as an Asian man. So I was trying to build this case, almost like a lawyer putting together a files for a case that he's going to present to some world court or something. That's what the purpose of those files were.
Let's go to the phones now. 866. I think this is going to be fun. 866-733-6786. Beginning with Navi in Oakland. Navi, good morning.
Hi. So I called in, and this topic has something I've been thinking about somewhat lately. I mean, I was an Asian boy when I was an Asian boy growing up in school. And I've been called my fair share of many racial slurs, and people thought I was Chinese. And I told them, people, I'm not Chinese. I'm Cambodian. Yes, we do look a little Chinese-like, but I'm not Chinese. But I was just lumped in with everyone else. But now, like 2 decades later, I'm in that stage of my life where, like, now everyone's finding a partner. And I feel like a lot of these Asian stereotypes are really hurting, about the Asian male stereotypes are really hurting me.
I think, Navi, thank you for sharing that. I think, Alex, that's something that you talk about at length in the book, in terms of the way that the stereotypes not only affect how people deal with you in business or in society, but in romance and sex and dating.
Oh, yeah.
And remember, this is public radio, so we got to keep it PG. But besides that, right, there is a real impact.
I'll clean up my language. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the whole image of Asian men being small in every way, I think impacts the way people perceive us, the way women perceive us, and most importantly, it impacts the way Asian men growing up in the West perceive themselves, which is the thing that really ultimately I had to overcome. Yeah, man, it's tough for a lot of Asian dudes to put it, you know, colloquially, to get the girl. Not many exceptions. There are many exceptions, and more every day. But in the 60s and 70s and 80s, particularly the 60s and 70s, it was harder for Asian men to be accepted among women and groups of women, mostly American white women.
And you talk about that in the book in terms of Asian men being in some ways feminized for the intellectual, philosophical, the roots of Asian culture that I think make various Asian cultures fascinating and beautiful, but from a Western male perspective, make it seem less than manly, not that kind of brash, broad-shouldered kind of American, you know, ham-fisted, hairy-knuckled, you know, image that we have of the Western American male. However,
I've got hair on my knuckles.
Well, you know, I got 6 or 7. But for Asian females, as you write, that exact same stereotype augurs so well for Asian females, it fetishizes them.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I have 6 sisters, man, and they're all incredibly smart, all incredibly beautiful, but they do deal with this Asian fetish that a lot of Western men seem to have of Asian women. They have an idea of them as being hyper-feminine. So yes, so when you look at, if you look at the Asian race, as if there was such a thing,
right,
as being more feminine than other races, then the women are ultra feminine, more feminine than other women, and the men are slightly less masculine, more feminine than other groups of men. So in that equation, the men lose more; they're hurt more by that. But I have to say that the Asian women have their own challenges too.
Let's go back to the phone. Srini in San Jose. Srini, good morning.
Morning. Can you hear me okay?
I can indeed. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just had a comment and a question. The comment was that I work in Silicon Valley, and there is this stereotype of Asian men. They are, you know, somewhat diffident, self-effacing, soft-spoken. And when they encounter someone who is who's otherwise, people are really surprised. I mean, I get this feedback that, well, you are different. And the question I had was, when it comes to raising Asian kids in the U.S., do you have any thoughts to offer on that? I'll take my own, you know, off on the air.
You know what? I may have missed a word. Did he ask me what I would teach Asian American children, Asian children? Was that the question?
I believe so, in the U.S., yeah.
I would, if at all possible, I would try to keep them in touch with their lineage and to point out what they can be proud of and what they're capable of. You know, one thing that I missed growing up in the 60s and 70s in the United States was I didn't learn anything about Asia at all. I couldn't name a single preeminent Asian figure who was a force for good when I graduated high school. I had to learn that stuff on my own in college. I think that if you can have your children remain in touch with people like them from their culture who did good things, great things, it would for them expand the outlines of what they're capable of, if that makes sense.
Let's go back to the phones. Judy in Sacramento. Judy, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you. I am a child of immigrants. My mother was born in Poland. My father was born in Holland. And both of them are Holocaust survivors. And I just felt so different growing up in Pennsylvania. And I hated, honestly, and, it, you know, it hurts and it's embarrassing to say, but I hated being a child of Holocaust survivors because there was so much pain involved. And I just wanted to be an American. I didn't understand what my parents went through. And I spent so much time trying to fit in with my friends because I didn't have any friends who had a background like that. And then I ended up writing a book, about called Proud Americans, Growing Up as Children of Immigrants. And I interviewed people whose parents were from all over the world, including the Philippines, including a young lady whose family was from Africa, and she grew up in the South, and all of the prejudice she faced, just like you're talking about now. Not until I got older did I realize, hey, I've got a lot to be proud of. What's wrong with me? I don't have to fit in. You know, I like being different.
You know, Judy, you make a good point. Thanks for the call. It is kind of, Alex, I imagine, easy to feel like, and you talk about this in the book, Big Little Man, about wanting to kind of break away from that culture and really westernize, to be able to find the inner American that's just trying to get out.
Yes, I think a lot of immigrants go through the same process. I describe it in very dramatic ways in the book. I call it self-annihilation, because that's what it felt like in my family. We had to, in order to become that American that we idealized, in order to fit in, we had to essentially erase parts of ourselves, and that's what I call self-annihilation. The worst part is not just erasing those parts, but then rejecting them altogether. So, for example, for many years, I rejected my own face. I looked at my face in the mirror. It sure didn't look American to me. How could I be an American with this face? Every person that I learned about in school, that I see in movies and television, every heroic person, any person I could be, any person that I looked up to or admired, didn't have a face like mine growing up. That's changing, of course, but. So the idea that you have to let go of yourself or to erase yourself or even reject yourself, I think that is an experience that's common to many immigrants. I didn't know it was universal at the time.
We're coming up on a break in a few minutes. We're going to continue this conversation on the other side of the break. We got a few more minutes, and I definitely want to get to as many calls and emails as possible. Here are a few emails from listeners. One listener writes, "The biggest association I had with Asian males growing up is that they practiced martial arts. Nothing is more macho than the guy who breaks bricks and boards with his bare hands." Gracie writes, "Pretty funny. I am a Caucasian woman in her 50s. In my teenage years, I had the most massive crush on David Takahashi. He was so cool, long hair down to his waist, great guitarist, beautiful, and I thought really sexy. So maybe Asian men don't know how to ask?" Ramon writes, "Hey, Alex, we're not Asian. We're Pacific Islander, man." And John from El Cerrito writes, "When your guest described growing up, he described the Chinese as indifferent to him because he is Filipino. Is he suggesting the Chinese in general are racially exclusive? Could he talk about racism in the Asian community? Does it exist? How does it manifest itself? Are Filipinos more or less racist than Chinese?" Let's take that one before we go to our break.
Oh, man, that's a great question. I mean, Asians can be and are as inclined toward racism as any other group. So if you go to Asia, for example, there is a racial hierarchy in Asia. And I'll tell you what, the Chinese are on top, or certainly perceive themselves on top of that hierarchy.
Kind of a caste system.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Filipinos are way at the bottom of that. We're the servant class in the Philippines. We are, if I may say it, we have long been considered the Negroes of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And we live with that status in Asia. And that is a form, I don't know if you'd call it racism, but there's certainly a caste system. And the caste, you can see various. The caste breaks up into nationalities and skin colors. Yes.
I want to unpack that a little bit more after the break. We're speaking to Alec Tizon, author of Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self, unpacking some stereotypes about Asian men for the hour. Glad you're with us. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing stereotypes about Asian men with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Alex Tizon. He's the author of the new book, Big Little Man, In Search of My Asian Self. Join the conversation. Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Speaking of tweets, before we go on, I got a lovely tweet from my friend Michelle Norris at NPR News. She has suggested her project, the Race Card Project, has a lot of feedback on this very issue. For those of you who've been listening to All Things Considered, you know that Michelle has been collecting six-word phrases from people about their experiences with race. Some of them do deal with Asian heritage. They deal with really people of all heritages. One of them says in the six words, hybrid Asian identity, disconnected from roots. And then there's an explanation of what that means, kind of unpacking that. So do check that out. It's theracecardproject.com. Thank you very much, Michelle, for sharing that idea. Let me go to a few emails. Divya writes, "Hi, I'm an Asian woman, Indian to be precise. The stereotype that I really hate is that most men assume that I will be subservient or won't speak up for myself, even Asian men." What's up with that? Mary writes, "As a white American woman, I am more attracted to Asian men, not only for an often more refined style, but for a more mindful, intellectual, and interesting character. However, I've never been able to have a successful relationship with an Asian man, and most who say they like American women have never and would never date one. In my experience, many white women would date an Asian man, but the men would not date a white woman. Can you speak to the issues that keep them from successful interracial relationships?" I'm sure you've had the exact opposite experience, Alex. That doesn't sound at all like what you've experienced.
No. In fact, in my experience, the Asian men that I grew up with really almost worshipped white women. I mean, to a degree that was really wrong. I was married. My first marriage was to a woman of Irish and German descent. Tall, long, slender, really beautiful, actually. And we looked to white women as an ideal, the way many Asians look to white men and women as an ideal.
Well, in the way many people of color have looked at women of European descent as an ideal of beauty.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, it has to do with the fact that, you know, Europe controlled the world still does for a few centuries.
How do you deal with those issues of race in a relationship to make the relationship work?
You know what? From my experience, I don't want to sound like Dr. Phil here, but from my experience, the issues of race quickly become secondary. And it does become an issue of just two people trying to figure out how they fit with one another. Sometimes your cultural and ethnic inclinations come into play. But if you can get beyond that, it's about you and the one woman in front of you. It has nothing to do with her race or your race, ultimately.
But you do have to be able to call out some of those things. I mean, sometimes, you know, people of different cultures, and you talk about this a little bit in the book, come with certain, I don't want to use the word baggage. Baggage is the wrong word. So come with certain preconceptions,
yes,
certain cultural norms,
yes, yes,
about the role of men and the role of women and the role of families. And at times, those two can butt heads, and you just have to find a way to unpack that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So, for example, my first marriage to this beautiful, wonderful Irish German woman, she came from her family was very Germanic, and Germanic people tend to be more formal, a little more detached. They don't like great expressions of affection, certainly not in public, which was the opposite of my family. My family was dramatic, kind of loud, colorful, you know, hugged people, wanted to get close right away. Had a different sense of family. So when my family and her family got together, you know, it was like two camps who stayed in different parts of the park. I mean, we may have said hello in the middle.
But that was about it.
Niceties, yes. And then we'd go back to our various camps. There was no melding at all. And it was partly because of culture. Germanic culture, Northern European culture, and ways of interacting with family, for example, very different from Southeast Asian views of family and how family should interact.
Makes for very interesting family reunions. All right, I'm going to get quiet. Let's go to the phones. Phil in Oakland. Phil, good morning.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure. What's on your mind?
So I'm a Chinese American, and I also happen to be a Chinese American actor. And one of the things that I kind of was dealing with when I first started acting as a kid in film was that a lot of the auditions I was getting were for very, very specific things, you know, and we need some people to stand around and look Chinese in Chinatown. We need a Korean grocery store owner. We need, you know, random thug of the Yakuza gang and things like that. And I found, actually, that when I transitioned into theater, I always did theater, but when I started doing theater, it was a lot more accepting of that sort of thing. And something that's interesting is that there's this perception of Asian people in the media that's being perpetuated by live performance and by movies and by TV and stuff like that. And the best way for Asian people to really dispel that image, to shift that paradigm, is to get out and start, especially performers, to start auditioning for roles that don't necessarily fit them.
Just so you got to put yourself out there.
Just go out there and do it anyway. And I guess that was just a comment that I wanted to make. I guess the question I had to your guests was were there any idols you had on TV or in movies who kind of inspired you, who were kind of dispelling that paradigm and things like that?
As an Asian? You mean Asian characters that inspired me?
Yeah, Asian characters, TV, movies.
Well, that was the problem. In the 60s and 70s, there were very, very few Asian male characters on television and movies that you could look up to. There was Hop Singh from Bonanza. He was a stock character. He was the houseboy. And houseboy, Asians do a lot of houseboy roles. And so it was really an embarrassment to me to see Asian men in particular were depicted in movies and theater. The first person who really broke through was Bruce Lee, and that was in the mid 70s. He was an example or a manifestation of Asian power, but he was still pretty one dimensional, like martial artist actors tend to be. They're one-dimensional characters. I still craved for a multi-dimensional character that was complicated and yet someone you can also admire.
You wanted an Asian Sidney Poitier.
There you go, man. Still looking for him.
Let's go back to the...
Still looking.
Joy in San Leandro. Joy, good morning. Hi, Joy. You there?
Oh, yes, I am.
Oh, hey there.
Thank you. I didn't hear my name. So.
That's okay. What's on your mind?
I'm a little nervous, so forgive me.
Take a breath. We're all friends.
I have a couple of positive comments to make about Asian men, and I felt really strongly about it. So thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'm an engineer. I'm a mechanical engineer. And so I'm nerdy myself, and I find that attractive in other men. So... granted, I'm a woman working in a male-dominated field, so the men that I noticed who were Asian, I mean, they had to be nerdy because that kind of goes with the territory, but because I worked in a male-dominated field, I faced a lot of hostility from other men. I was often the only woman in my work group, but the few Asian men that I came in contact with were the most polite and respectful men welcoming me as a minority. So, I mean, the fact that they were kind and they weren't competitive with me and they just treated me like a normal person, I mean, I think those qualities are very attractive, and that's my idea of what a good man is. That was one of my points. Another point was that the only negative generalizations that I've heard about Asian men were from other men. who obviously were not Asian, but they would make those comments if they caught me talking to an Asian man or even flirting. So
what kinds of comments are you talking about? Like, what would they say?
They say he's not a real man. They'd use racial epithets that I'd rather not say on the radio.
Right.
And you know, I can't think of any other words, but it was really, and they'd laugh at him, and I just thought they were idiots. And so that made the men who talked to me that much more masculine, if that makes any sense. Because if you have to put somebody else down in order to feel good about yourself, you're just a wuss.
Yeah, that's a good word for it, Joy. Thank you very much. Let's go to the next call. Leroy in San Francisco. Leroy, good morning.
Hi. Yeah, it seems to me like this book or this guy is actually reinforcing stereotypes, not enlightening us about them. I mean, I never thought of Filipinos as Asian. I always thought of them as Pacific Islanders, and I always thought of Turkish men and Afghanistan men as Asian. And to be a little cynical, I'm sorry I'm going to say this, but to me it seems like this guy's just hawking a book to a big market of Asian men.
Well, let's give him a chance to respond to your criticism, Leroy. Thanks for bringing that up. And that actually, Alex, was a question that I had in terms of the way that you put this book together. You almost have to put the stereotypes back out there in order to unpack them. How do you broach this subject without reinforcing the stereotypes about men from the Asian diaspora?
Well, I don't know if it's possible to talk about this without unpacking some of it and exploring it. And I think that for Leroy, I would encourage you to please read the whole book, and then we can have a conversation, because you know the book does follow a narrative arc, and there is a journey aspect to it. So the first half of the book is about me. It's about my own confronting of these stereotypes, which I have. I talked about them very candidly. And toward the end of the book, I talk a little bit about how I work through some of these issues and how I now live with these stereotypes, which is very different from how I lived with them as a teenager. So, for example, much of the book takes place 40 years ago. I'm 54 now, and my experiences today are vastly different from my experiences as a teenager.
Yeah, and having gone through the narrative of this book, it really does, you know, and I do take Leroy's point clearly that it's easy to reinforce those stereotypes, but the way that it's written, at least in my reading of it, it does a good job of presenting those things, unpacking them, and then telling some of the true history behind what these stereotypes are. I mean, the story just of Magellan in the Philippines, I was like, what? He got what? And they did what to him?
He got sliced and diced,
I never knew that story. I'm hearing, Magellan, first one to circumnavigate the globe. No, he didn't.
He didn't make it.
He started the voyage and he died in the Philippines because he got his you-know-what kicked.
Yeah.
That's a story I never knew.
Yeah. It was a great story. And I love that story.
There's a lot of stories like that.
But nobody's heard of Lapu-Lapu, the man who conquered him. Everyone's heard of Magellan.
Exactly. You got to read the book. It's a worthwhile story. You got to read the book. Mike in San Jose. Mike, good morning.
Hello. My name is it's Ike.
Hi, Mike. What's on your mind?
Yeah. My name is Ike.
Ike. I beg your pardon. Ike.
Okay. No problem. Hey, what is it? He's telling my story. I'm 54 years old. I'm Filipino. And I came here when I was 2 years old. And what I wanted to comment on is, me as a Filipino male growing up in this culture during the 60s and 70s, I try to legitimize myself as an immigrant by getting together or trying to date primarily white women, you know? And it's interesting that my brother and sister, we all married outside of our race. And in that time that I was dating, right? You know, it wasn't until I went to Japan where I met my wife, who's Japanese, that, you know, I realized, well, I there are all these beautiful Asian women out there that I had denied myself. But, you know, coming to America, the whole idea of the beauty, the ideal of beauty was the blonde hair, blue-eyed, and I wanted to be seen at a ringside heavyweight fight with that tall blonde. And like my best friend, who is Mexican-American, has married a tall blonde as well. So I wanted to comment on that, and I wonder how he felt about that as well.
How I felt about white women and my attraction to them?
Yeah, about that additional aspect of the interracial dating coupling.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, I had no choice because my family moved and a lot, and we settled in towns where the vast majority of people were white. So I went to schools where the vast majority of the student population was white. All my classmates were white. All the women that were considered most desirable were white. The women that were most desirable on television were white and in the movies. And so getting a white woman was the thing that we strived for, my brothers and I anyway. And in fact, we did. We all married white women, our first marriages. And you know, the way I put it in the book is that once you peek under the skirt of that mythology, you find that they're just like other women.
It kind of pierces the veil and, the mystique.
Women are women, yeah.
I noticed there are a number of people who are writing about being Asian and gay. One listener writes, "I've noticed that within the gay community, it's very common to see older white men with younger Asian men." Anthony writes, "As a Gaysian..." I like that portmanteau, a Gaysian. "The no fats, no femmes, no Asians trope is prevalent in social media and culture. I just got back from Israel, ran the app Grindr, which is a hookup app, and it popped up. I have encountered that a number of times, and it makes me kind of crazy. I'm gay, and I have encountered men of every race and background and culture, but I have encountered in San Francisco a number of men who have this, like, this Asian stereotype thing, and it's the exact same thing you write about in the book. And to me, it just kind of calls into question this idea of whether diverse groups, minorities, recreate the caste system from which they emerged, or whether they are actually more open. I find that even in the Bay Area, that is not the case when it comes to Asian men, gay, straight, or otherwise.
Well, wow, you said a lot there.
it's what I've encountered. Then maybe that's it. Maybe we just go to another call. Daniel in Oakland, good morning.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to comment that as a half Filipino, half Irish person growing up in the Bay Area, I found it a lot easier to actually connect with the Hispanic community here than actually with the Asian community. I felt it very hard to break through and connect with people of Asian descent here.
Hey, Daniel,
I wonder if you had any comment on that.
Daniel, why is that? Why did you find it easier to relate more to Hispanic people than to Asians?
It's hard to say. I think I shared more socioeconomic kind of ties with them, and we just kind of shared the same interests. And during, you know, school, I'd try to go on the playground and hang out with maybe like a Chinese or Japanese group of people, as was common. And it just felt very hard to break through and feel comfortable around them.
Daniel, you know, Filipinos are Hispanic. That's the unique part of the Philippines. It was it's the only Catholic country in Asia. The Spaniards occupied our country for four centuries. You go to the Philippines, you go to Manila, and it looks just like Mexico City. Spanish is part of the language, part of the cuisine, part of the culture. And so, you know, when I have to check those boxes on government forms, what nationality or ethnicity or race I am, I always check Asian, Hispanic, Pacific Islander, and other, because that's what Filipinos are. And more, that's what people of the world are. We're all mongrelized. We're all hybrids of all kinds of different groups. But I completely relate to you. Yeah, I mean, we have a lot in common with Hispanics. We really do.
Let me go to a comment from Twitter, which kind of hits on something that I had been thinking as soon as this book came up. What about Sulu in Star Trek? for a complicated Asian role model, a unique Asian role model. I have to admit, growing up as, you know, a little black child, I did not have any of these stereotypes about Asians. And I know a lot of black kids who didn't have them either, because I know a lot of black kids who grew up idolizing Bruce Lee. Kung Fu culture was my inlet to Asian culture, and a profound respect, not just of loving, you know, Game of Death and Enter the Dragon and all the movies, which I've seen 10,000 times.
You and I have watched the same movies.
Yeah, a million times. But reading The Tao of Jeet Kune Do, I know a lot of little black kids who read that book. And you can poke fun at the Wu-Tang Clan all you want, but they have been to the Shaolin Temple. They have a deep knowledge of Asian cultures and philosophies. So I have to admit, for me, I kind of struggled with this book. I was like, I never thought that about Asian people. I grew up loving Bruce Lee and Mr. Sulu and thinking, oh, Asian's cool. That's kind of neat.
You know, I bring up early on in the book, first of all, that I don't claim to speak for all Asian people. Not at all. The only thing I tried to do is tell my own story. And you know what? It's very possible that what I experienced was just an Alex Tizon thing and not an Asian man thing. So a lot of what I bring up in the book is told through the lens of my own experiences, which could be very, very different to the Asian guy or the black guy or the white guy standing right next to me.
Here's an email from listener Roxanne. She writes, I moved out here from the Midwest with my first husband in 1976. We're both Caucasian. We divorced in 1990, and as I began to date, I was very open to other races, but thought I would have no interest in Asian men. I bought into the stereotypes. They're small, not sexy, not that manly, not very emotional. In short, not for me. But then I met the man who is now my husband, a Japanese American, and he shattered all those stereotypes. He's funny, sexy, and one of the manliest men I have ever met, and he is kind and emotionally available. Marrying him and bringing him into my family and circle of friends has unpacked their stereotypes as well. He is the unexpected love of my life.
Wow.
Thanks for sharing that, Roseanne. Congratulations, by the way. Let's go back to the phone. Shayna in Davis. Shayna, good morning.
Oh, hi. Sorry.
Hi there.
I think I was trying to address an earlier point about discrimination within Asians themselves. You know, I'm a Korean American. I was actually born in the U.S., but I'm just listening to my dad talk to me about our heritage and pride and, you know, our culture and everything has kind of, I've seen repetitions of similar things within other ethnicities, like, you know, Indians, Chinese, so on and so forth. And I think, at least for Koreans, I can't really speak much to others, but I think Chinese and Japanese tend to share a lot of the same things, is that, you know, we're very focused on our social standing. And, you know, bringing respect and prestige to both ourselves and to our families, even if we may not consciously think of that, but that's really hammered into us from early on. So you're constantly kind of, well, at least my parents are constantly comparing themselves to other people within their own kind of social standing, who's above them, who's below them. And, you know, my father in particular believes he's at the top because we were descended from royalty. You know, he can trace back our line to the first generation from when our name began.
So that kind of creates additional pressure within the culture and additional, you know, additional tension, I imagine.
Yeah, but I think it's more kind of to generalize things. It's sort of why I feel like a lot of, you know, when he was speaking earlier that the Chinese wanted nothing to do with him, it's like it's more of a generalized discrimination almost. It's like, oh, both in social standing and ethnic standing, like, you know, we don't really have anything to do with, you know, this group of people.
Well,
I feel that's just so common within, I feel like, all our cultures.
It's the reality in Asia. I mean, we in you know, Asia, the people who live in Asia don't see themselves as Asians. They see themselves as Koreans or Japanese or Filipinos or Taiwanese. It's really only when you travel to a foreign land like the United States where we are all lumped into a category. It used to be Orientals. Now we're Asians. But yeah, I hear you there. I hear you. I only talk about myself as an Asian in these abstract discussions of race and ethnicity. But day to day, I'm a Filipino.
Susan writes by email, I've been finding this conversation really interesting. I work at an advocacy organization that focuses on domestic violence in Asian and Pacific Islander families. One thing that we find really destructive about the stereotypes about Asian men is that sometimes people don't believe they can be capable of the same kinds of violence that you would find in any other group. That can make it difficult for Asian and Pacific Islander women to be taken seriously when they report abuse, which further isolates and traumatizes them. In a similar way, Asians are thought of as the model minority, which many people consider a good stereotype, as if such a thing could exist. We are drowning in emails and questions. Thank you so much for this.
May I talk on that?
Please do.
Yeah, the model minority image has always bothered me, because I've always seen what's underneath that image, and I've seen what Asians and Asian immigrants live like on street level, and there are serious problems there. There may be some aspects of Asian American community that are worth noting and that are worth admiring, but the model minority idea fails to see the deep problems that affect these communities, and that's why I don't like that label.
Let's try and squeeze in one more call. Andrew in Palo Alto. Andrew, good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. Briefly, please.
Yeah, so I'm a Chinese American in my early 30s, and you know, going through the dating pool, especially in college in my 20s, has been really challenging. I'm currently engaged to a Caucasian woman, but overcoming the stereotypes of an Asian American male being, you know, kind of effeminate and meek or whatever people perceive them to be was extremely challenging. And I find that to get through that filter very early on is really difficult. And then when they find out that, oh, you know, I was in a fraternity in college or I was a Marine, and all of a sudden they're surprised that I took on these more, I don't know, stereotypically masculine roles. And I feel that there are a lot of Asian men like myself out there. I've been talking about this a lot with my friends and my peers lately. I find that there's a lot of people out there like that. But to get through that filter of that stereotype of, you know, they're meek and they're effeminate has been really challenging.
I imagine so. Alex, we're almost out of time for the hour. Last thoughts on this? The one thing that you would want people to take away from this, from the book, as they decide whether or not to read it or not. Final thoughts.
You bet. The final thought has to do with the fact that ultimately the solution to all this, personally and socially, ironically, has nothing to do with race. So the book begins looking through the lens of race and looking at myself through the lens of race. But that's really not the most accurate or compassionate way to look at your life. The key for me in solidifying my identity has been tuning into a purpose larger than myself, outside of myself. And then guess what? People will come to you if you do that.
Alex Tizon, the book is called Big Little Man in Search of My Asian Self. Alex, what a wonderful hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you, Josh.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Leslie Chang, Kathy Shield, Hannah Kingsley Ma, Charlie Zaharoff, Eric Nygaard, and Kaylin Dakin. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.